Great to have all of you here. Welcome to our Wednesday night study. It's a warm day. I think it was in the 90s today, but it is cool in here. So praise the Lord for that. We're in 2 Samuel tonight. 2 Samuel chapter 19. You know, one of the reasons I love the Old Testament is that, you know, the stories in there we can read, we can learn from. The New Testament is highly applicational, and it tells us a lot about how believers should live and things that are expected of us, things that we can expect from life. You know, Jesus says things like, blessed are you when you're persecuted, so we know that's going to be part of the deal. But we also come to Revelation, we come to parts of the New Testament that promise us a future and a hope. It's very encouraging, very motivating, and it is to be that. So if that's what you're getting out of the New Testament, that's great. But the truth is, the New Testament really doesn't have a whole lot of relevance without the Old Testament, without knowing where it comes from and why it's so important and the building blocks that it took to get to the point of the birth of Jesus. So we go through the Old Testament here on Wednesday is usually the books that we've been in. And I love it because as we look at the Old Testament through the lens of the New Testament, we can see how things are building toward Christ. We can see pictures of Jesus, images of him, things called Christophanies, which are images or allusions to Jesus from or in the Old Testament. People like Joseph, for example, who are betrayed by his own brethren, his own nation, his brothers, sold into slavery for 30 pieces of silver, and who then redeems the very people who put him there. And you read that story and you think, well, that's Christ. Or you read the story of Noah and the ark and you think, well, that sounds a lot like Jesus, because here you have Noah, a man who lives in a fallen world, who is himself a sinner, but who is called by God to build on faith this giant boat because God says judgment's coming and you've got to get into my ark and you've got to do it my way. And if you do, you're going to be spared, and anybody who doesn't won't be. And so Noah gets in the ark, him and his family, a handful of people in the whole world, along with the animals. The ark shuts them in, secures them through all the storms, and then delivers them to a new world, so to say, to dry land after the waters start to recede. Well, that's a picture of Jesus. So you can look through the Old Testament, you can see pictures and images, and you can see kind of these glimpses of Christ and everything that we're going to receive in the New Testament, but here in these 39 books of the Old. So I love going through it. I think it's a great thing to study. It gives us an appreciation for what we have and how it got to be there. And that's what this has been all about. We're studying the book of 2 Samuel, although it really is the story of the life of David. As you know, it's David who comes from the line of Judah, and it's David's line that will birth the kings of Israel. And later, Jesus, as he's born from Mary, can trace his lineage all the way back through the house of David, through the tribe of Judah. It's just an amazing story. So that's where we are. That's what we're looking at, David's time as king. And it has been a turbulent one, but it's where we pick up here in chapter 19. Let's pray before we get too far ahead of ourselves. Father, we do thank you for tonight. And we thank you, Lord, for the chance to be together here. We thank you for the opportunity to study, to open your word, to read and understand and apply these things to our life. Father, I pray that as we do that tonight, that this would not just be an ancient story, but this would be something that sheds light on the very real and present ministry of Jesus Christ in our lives. Lord, I pray that's what we would get out of this as we open up to this book, to this chapter, on this night, as we come together in Jesus' name. Amen. As I was mentioning, we study the Bible a book at a time, a chapter at a time, a verse, a line at a time. We have as our book of the month, and I think it's just a neat one. It's called How to Read the Bible Book by Book, so it's really a good tool. I mentioned it on Sunday because This is a unique book. It's not a chapter book. You're not going to put this like on your nightstand and then read chapter 3 tonight and chapter 4 tomorrow night. It's not a commentary. It's not a dictionary. It's kind of unique. It's a high-altitude view of giant swaths of the Bible, whole passages, sections of books, whole books in some cases. But it gives you a sense of who's involved, what's going on, the time, the culture, the major players, the dates, all the good stuff that's going to give you a sense of what it is that's happening in this passage. Because it's easy to jump into a part of the Bible, not really know what's going on, not recognize it. There's some foreign languages happening, and just kind of miss a lot of the meaning. Well, this is going to help kind of plug those gaps. It's called How to Read the Bible Book by Book. It is our book of the month in the bookstore. But for something like this, it's a very good kind of companion to the Bible, as are commentaries. We have a number of those in the bookstore, as are other references. But ultimately, your Bible, a good study Bible, is going to be worth its weight in gold because it's going to unlock for you the blessings of God. And so we study that tonight. But as I mentioned, we're in chapter 19 of 2 Samuel, looking at this life of David. And David's life has been a life filled with adventure, I think, to say the least. As a young man, he's tapped on the shoulder to go fight Goliath. He does. He's then anointed to be king over Israel, even though Saul still sits on the throne. And so, although he serves Saul very valiantly and very honorably, Saul becomes jealous of David and envious, very suspicious of him. I think if Saul lived during modern times, we would say he was clinically paranoid. He might be schizophrenic. He's got a lot of stuff going on in his head that are not reflected in life. But nonetheless, it leads him to pursuing and trying to kill David on many occasions. So David flees, and for 14 years, he's on the run. I mean, I don't know what that would be like to hear this promise from the Lord, to have the prophet and the priest Samuel come and say, God has chosen you to be king, and then to be run out of town by the guy that you've been serving loyally your whole life, only to then have to flee for your life. David ultimately ends up in the land of the Philistines. He starts to doubt God's promises. He comes back. Saul, as you know, is killed in battle on Mount Gilboa. David comes into the scene as king. But it's not an easy thing if you remember the beginning of 2 Samuel. There's instant division. And one of the generals of Saul starts putting Saul's children up on the throne. You remember that. That leads to battle. David wins. The country is united. David sins with Bathsheba, kills her husband Uriah the Hittite to cover up the affair. Because of the sin, however, the child dies, and Nathan the prophet, if you remember his prophecy over David's life, David repents, and Nathan says, because you've repented, God isn't going to kill you, but, he tells him, the sword will never depart from your household. A pretty ominous prophecy. There's going to be violence in David's life for the rest of his days, for the rest of his children's days. And I would submit to you that prophecy is still being felt by the people of Israel in 2023. Do you know that ever since David's sin with Bathsheba, Israel has not known lasting peace? Well, since then, they've been either occupied or besieged or they've been dispersed, but they've not known true lasting peace. And even to this very day, Israel fights for its survival every single morning. You know, there are people who study world politics and they say, if Israel laid down their weapons, I'm sorry, if the nations surrounding Israel laid down their weapons tomorrow, there would be peace in the Middle East. If Israel laid down their weapons tomorrow, there would be no Israel the day after. That is the reality, that is the life that they live, and it can be traced all the way back to what we're reading here in 2 Samuel, to David's sin with Bathsheba. But that's the prophecy, the sword will never depart from your home, and it hasn't. David raises 20 children by 8 wives, again, something God specifically commanded him not to. Not only was polygamy never okay in the Bible, But the kings of Israel were uniquely commanded to not multiply wives or concubines after themselves, yet David takes 8 wives. Well, there's no good that's going to come from that. His sons grow up, they fight. One son rapes his sister. His son Absalom kills him in revenge. Absalom's run out of town, and of course that relationship falls apart. Absalom comes back, and he's so bitter against his father David for the years of neglect and for the years of exile that he leads this rebellion. So there's another civil war in Israel. It will claim the lives of tens of thousands of young men. That civil war is kind of what we're coming into the end of here. Absalom has been killed. In fact, it was Joab. It was David's own general that did it. But that's going to lead to even more problems down the road. But that's where we are. David is in the midst of this life, and it's not been an easy one. In fact, the first part of the book of 2 Samuel could be kind of titled David's Triumphs. He wins battle after battle. He's conquering land. He's expanding Israel's territory. He's living well within God's promises and his blessing. He's triumphing as a king. But then he comes to his sin with Bathsheba, and from then until now, we have David's troubles, and he is in trouble. Well, his son's been killed. Absalom's been run through. In fact, he was killed by a mob led by Joab. He was stabbed multiple times, and he's getting the news that his boy has died. And so David hears that, and he says, "Oh, Absalom, my son, I wish I would have died instead of you." It's kind of where we left off last week. David's in the middle of this grief, and I think there's a lot of reasons behind the grief. He's a parent, he's lost yet another son. That in and of itself would be devastating. But then there's also, I think, in his mind, just the reality of the fact that this is because of him. Certainly, his mind goes back to the days of Nathan, goes back to the days of Bathsheba, goes back to that time when he was warned that there's going to be violence, there's going to be turmoil and division in your household. And he's now dealing with the death of yet another child because of that one sin. He's still living in the midst of that. And I think everything in David is honest when he says he wishes it was him instead. You know, there's something to be said of the curse, I will say, of living in the perpetual aftermath of a sinful act. You know, people sometimes think that they got away with it because either they weren't caught or there weren't consequences. And yet then one thing happens after another, and it's like all of this is because of that. And you can trace it back to that very event. Well, that's where David is. He's living in the midst of this. His son is dead. His trusted general has killed him. And so we left off about there in chapter 19 last week. It says, "The king arose and sat in the gate," in verse 8. "When they told all the people, saying, 'Behold, the king is sitting in the gate,' then all the people came before the king." Now Israel had fled each to his tent. "All the people were quarreling throughout the tribes of Israel, saying, 'The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines, but now he's fled out of the land of Absalom.'" So you can see, even though Absalom is gone, there's still this remnant of the problem. I mean, David is mourning the loss of his son. He's kind of gotten back to the point of trying to get back to normal life again. He's gone through this process of grief. He's gone from denial to anger to bargaining to depression to acceptance. He's gone through all of those steps. He's trying to get back to a semblance of normal life, but yet here is still the aftermath of the rebellion and the civil war. There are those who believe that he's fled out of the land of Absalom. So, well, that's not right, is it? It's not Absalom's land. Absalom wasn't coronated king. He wasn't anointed by Samuel. David was, but yet the division is still there. The scarring is still there. It doesn't just go away overnight because the leader has been killed. Now there is a real need for healing in the nation. And there's quarreling, there's anger, there's arguing among all the people, it says. We're quarreling throughout all the tribes of Israel. Instability in leadership, whether it's in a nation or a business, a church, wherever it is, instability in the leadership never leads to stability in the general populace. When leaders don't get along, that sends ripple effects through everyone else. Just look at what we deal with in the political landscape of our nation. We've got Congress that is always divided right down the middle. The biggest decisions of our lives are made by people who are voting along party lines more often than not, and a great one-sided landslide victory these days is something like 52 to 48 in the Senate. It's a 51 or 52% majority on one side and a 48 or 49% minority on the other side. But that's considered decisive these days. I don't think you could look at that and say when you're 51 to 49 that you're really working together. But that's basically what we have. Everything has kind of turned into if we get more of our people, we can do what we want and you can't stop us. And each party, Republican and Democrat, they both basically say the same thing. We want more of ours on our side because then we can do what we want and they don't have enough votes to stop us. And unfortunately, many things, many decisions are being made that way in our nation and have been for years. Look at the results that it's created. We have an incredibly divided country, and we're divided among almost every possible metric that you can figure. There's divisions between gender, there's divisions between, you know, religion, economic status, race, you name it, people are lining up to be in one group or another. You know, Jesus said it well when he said, "A house divided can't stand." And it can't. There's not going to be harmony in that home. There's not going to be thriving in that home. Can you coast a little while? Sure. Can you survive a little while? Sure. Are you going to thrive? No. Is it eventually going to catch up with you? Yes. David is going to deal with that. He's still dealing with that. But there's division in Israel right now. Division in the government has led to division among the people, and the people are arguing in every single tribe in the entire nation. Would you agree that there's division and arguing in every state in our nation, in every county in our nation, in every town? Just go to the school board meetings and you'll see this stuff happen. It's a very powerful reminder that division never leads to blessing. You cannot bully people into submission and expect that great things are going to come from that. You know, in our nation, the greatest things have come from when we've united together, when we've bonded and banded together. During World War II, for example, nobody was Republican or Democrat. They were American. And because of that, although the GIs went and fought the evils of Nazi Germany and the Axis powers, everyone at home picked up and did something too, whether it was women taking over the factories while the men went and fought in the wars, or it was people on the coastlines turning out all their lights every single night so that they wouldn't be spotted by enemy patrols, or it was the rationing of goods like metal and rubber and clothing. Did you know that in Great Britain during World War II, it was actually made a law that women were not allowed to wear pleated dresses? It had to be a straight cut. And the reason for it was that pleating required extra fabric. And so the rationale was, well, we need fabric for the troops and for their uniforms and for hospital beds and for everything else. So they banned the pleating. Only they didn't really need a law. All they needed to do was tell the people, this is what we need, and people lined up. The same thing happened in our nation, and great things came from that kind of effort. You fast forward 50, 60 years, we have a very different environment, much like here. It says that they were all arguing throughout all the tribes of Israel. However, Absalom, who
"We anointed over us," they said, "he has died in battle. Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back?"
The guy they chose, he's been killed. There's another king. They're arguing over whether he can come back. The nation is divided. Some are still loyal to Absalom. Some want to see David return. Nobody can get along. There's factions popping up. And they're having a difficult time, I think, dealing with this sin. They have rebelled. The nation mutinied against David. They figured he was going to lose. There's Absalom. He's got the great generals. He's got all the people that David used to have. He's got the loyalty of the towns and communities. He's got the army. But wouldn't you know it, he didn't win. They bet on the wrong horse. And now Absalom's gone. David's coming back in. And I think, one, there's a little bit of shame in that. But if this was you, honestly, do you think any of us would be ready and willing and lining up to say, hey, let's welcome the old guy back, you know, the one we took up arms against? And just see how that's going to go. So the nation is arguing. They're divided. They don't know what to do. They don't want to bring back David. Some of them do. Not everybody went with Absalom. Some were loyal with David. But you see the fissure kind of starting. We see this kind of stuff, by the way, and I think I mentioned it last week, with online interactions with people. The ability to just kind of do things and have no accountability, to not have to answer for words and for hurtful things, to be able to kind of blow up someone's life and just like turn your screen off and walk away. That has created a whole new issue that the world has never seen before, because it used to be like this. If you did something, if you said something, if you took a position on something, ultimately you may have to be in a position to defend that. You may be called to the carpet for that. Well, they are here. They didn't think David would ever come back, but here he is. And so they're hesitant. So the king sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, saying, "Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the word of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house?" So you remember where David comes from. He's from the house of Judah. And so his own people don't even want to bring him back. "You are my brothers. You are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? Say to Amasa, are you not bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh? May God do so to me, and more also, if you will not be commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab." So you remember last week, he demotes Joab. He's mad with Joab because Joab killed Absalom. Joab is a great leader. Amasa, he betrayed David. He went and fought with Absalom, but nonetheless, Joab killed his boy. And so David said, "Amasa, you're going to be the general now." And so he brings him in. "Thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man. So they sent word to the king, saying, return you and all your servants. The king then returned and came as far as the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal in order to meet the king, to bring the king across the Jordan." Gilgal's an important place. Now, I don't really expect that everybody's always going to remember all these places or people or names, and I forget a lot of them too sometimes. There's just so much. But Gilgal is like an impressive thing. You remember from history how Abraham Lincoln delivered his Gettysburg Address from Gettysburg? Well, it was a very powerful statement. It wasn't very long. The whole speech is only about 200 words or so, you know, 67 years ago, our forefathers, and on and on and on. I won't say the whole thing. I don't know the whole thing, but you get the gist of it. It was a powerful speech. It was intended to be kind of the precursor to what would be the Emancipation Proclamation that Abraham Lincoln would sign. But he wanted to deliver that speech from a place that was meaningful. And so he was looking for a great victory from the Union to go and deliver this speech, this kind of platform of power and of military might and liberation. He was going to stand there and deliver this speech. So he did. He went to the battlefield at Gettysburg a couple days after the battle had been won. And he delivered that speech. It's remembered that way in history because there's just something about special places. And you can go there where Abraham Lincoln stood. You can go and see the battlefields. You can go to Valley Forge and all these other places where monumental things in history have happened. And there's just a specialness about being there. Well, Gilgal is kind of like that for Israel. The name itself means to be rolled away. And it was Gilgal where Saul was initially anointed king. But more importantly, it was Gilgal that Joshua crossed the Jordan at when he went to battle at Jericho. And so it was named to roll away, or Gilgal, because it says at Gilgal, they said, God rolled away our reproach. They came out of the land of the wilderness land, and for 40 years they'd been wandering. They come to the border of Cana, and they go in, and the first place they come is where? Jericho. So this is the place that they say, okay, the old is gone, our reproach is gone, God has forgiven us for all of that, for doubting him initially and saying we couldn't do it. And so he's rolled away our reproach here, we've won this battle at Jericho, this is where we crossed over, so that's what they name it, it's Gilgal. So for them it's a very powerful place. And it's where David goes to re-enter the king. And so he comes as far as the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to meet him there, and the king crossed the river. So he's coming back home through this very important kind of passageway. It's very symbolic. Then Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, with Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him. So they rushed to the Jordan before the king. Then they kept crossing the ford to bring over the king's household and to do what was good in his sight. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. So he said to the king, "Let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong on the day when my lord the king came out from Jerusalem, so that the king would take it to heart. For your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come today, the first of all the house of Joseph, to go down to meet my lord the king." So again, I know we might not always remember everything that happened, but you might remember Shimei and everything that he did. It was back in chapter 16. David was fleeing. He's running out of Jerusalem because Absalom has, you know, launched this rebellion against him. And it said that King David comes to Bahurim. Behold, there came out from there a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei of Gera. And Shimei cursed at David. He said, "Get out, you man of bloodshed, worthless fellow. The Lord has returned to you upon the bloodshed, the house of Saul, and the place you've reigned." So he basically says, look, you didn't belong here. You're a terrible guy. God's giving you what you deserve. And he was just waiting for the opportunity to tear David down. Again, figuring he's never going to see this guy again. Absalom's going to win. He can say his piece. There's not going to be any accountability. Surprise, spoiler alert, David wins the war. He comes back. Well, Shimei's got to deal with him. And David's going to remember that, even though he pretends like he won't. But Abishai, verse 21, the son of Zeruiah, said, "Should not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?" David then said, "What have I to do with you, O son of Zeruiah, that you should this day be an adversary to me? Should any man be put to death in Israel today? For do I not know that I am the king over Israel today?" The king said to Shimei, "You shall not die." Thus the king swore to him. So David's like, you know, we're not going to ruin the party here. I'm king again. You know, he's not going to die. You know, bygones are bygones, Shimei. I'm not going to kill you. Don't need to worry about that. Don't need to look over your shoulder. Except it doesn't seem that it will play out that way completely. Because later on, at the end of David's life, it's quite interesting, Solomon is born. Solomon grows up. Solomon becomes king. Before David dies, in fact, some of the last words he speaks to Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 2, I'll read them. "Behold, there is with you," he says to Solomon, "Shimei,
the son of Gera the Benjamite of Baharim. Now it was he who cursed me with a violent curse on the day I went to Mahanaim. But when he came down to meet me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. And so he doesn't. Shammai lives. Now therefore, he says, do not let him go unpunished. You're a wise man, and you will know what you ought to do to him, and you will bring his gray hair down to Sheol with blood. So David seems to be forgiving. He seems to be accommodating and understanding. Maybe he figures enough people have died. And although this guy deserves it, and he certainly would be justified in chopping his head off right then and there, he's, you know what, we're not going to ruin it. We're not going to ruin the party here because of this guy. And so, you know, you're going to live. But it's kind of like the Godfather, you know. He's giving orders to his son. He says, you know, I said I wouldn't kill him, but he cursed me. You're a smart man. You know what to do. And so he holds this grudge. And you know, Solomon will kill him, by the way. That same chapter later on, it says at the very end of the chapter, verses 45, 46, somewhere in there, that Solomon gives the order, and in fact, Shammai is killed. I think David was wise enough to know that sometimes in these kinds of situations, somebody has to be willing to stop. Someone has to be willing to take one on the chin so that there can be peace. Because if you strike back, if you get revenge, what are his children going to want to do? What are his family going to want to do? So they strike back in revenge for Shammai. Well, now David's family, they're going to have to go back at them. And he's seen enough of this. It's this Hatfield and McCoy kind of thing where nobody wants to be the one to say, okay, enough's enough. You get the last punch. You get the last word. That's okay, I'm going to walk away from it. And so I think David has realized something that Jesus taught us. And that is, look, if your neighbor hits you on the right side of the face, turn the left. If he hits you on the left, turn the right. If he takes your jacket, give him your shirt. Sometimes it's more important to suffer a little bit unjustly for the sake of peace than it is to keep a feud going that's going to kill people and destroy lives and destroy families. And I say that as kind of a word of advice to all of us, myself included. Not every argument needs to be won. Not every email needs to be replied to. Not every mean-spirited person needs to be confronted. Sometimes it's better to say, okay, you win. I'm going to move on with my life because you know what? I got a kingdom to run here. I've got a vision to go after. I've got a calling to fulfill. I've got more important things to do than sit here and keep this squabble going. So you know what? You can be right. You can win. That's fine. I'm going to go home to my family. We're going to have a great time, and we're going to forget all about this tomorrow. But I know that if I strike back now, even though I may be justified, it's never going to end. And so you know what? It's just not worth the fight anymore. I think David has seen enough, and he's not looking for more fighting. He's eager to get back on the throne. After all, he's just heard that he's king again, and so why is he going to ruin all that? Either way, he doesn't forget, because he's still a man. And at the end of his life, he tells his son, take care of this guy. Then Mephibosheth, and you remember Mephibosheth. Just real quick from our memory jog, Mephibosheth is the son of Jonathan. He's sometimes called the son of Saul because even grandchildren were called the son of. But Mephibosheth was the paralyzed or lame. He was the disabled son of Jonathan. And Jonathan and David had this pact. And Jonathan said, look, you're going to be king. I know this is going to happen. Please just don't withdraw your kindness from my household. David promises he never will. He keeps his word. And so he gives Mephibosheth all kinds of blessing, but Mephibosheth
is unable to do a lot for himself. Back in chapter 9, David gave him kindness. When we first meet Mephibosheth, he was the boy that had to be carried by the nurse when they were evacuating. And so it's him, Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, technically the grandson of Saul, but the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, and he had neither cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came home in peace. It was when he came home from Jerusalem to meet the king that the king said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" So he answered, "Oh, my lord, the king, my servant deceived me, for your servant said, 'I'll saddle a donkey for myself that I might ride over and go with the king because your servant is lame.' Moreover, he slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God, therefore do what is good in your sight. For all my father's household was nothing but dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those who ate at your own table. What right do I have yet that I should complain any more to the king?" So the king said to him, "Why do you still speak of your affairs? I've decided. You and Ziba shall divide the land." Mephibosheth said to the king, "Let him take it all, since the Lord my king has come safely to his own house." So Mephibosheth, again, the son of Jonathan, grandson of Saul, he has a servant named Ziba, and Ziba shows up a couple of chapters ago as a false servant. You might remember what happened. It was Ziba who saddled all these things. He had donkeys for the king. He rode out to meet David. And David's kind of curious, "Why do you have all this stuff? Where's your master?" And Ziba basically lies, and he looks like he's going to be generous and give all these things to David. But the truth is, he's false. He's got this agenda behind him. And so he goes out with Mephibosheth's stuff, and then he lies about Mephibosheth. Not only that, but then he allies himself with Absalom, hoping that the throne is going to go back to Saul. Well, Mephibosheth returns, and he says, "Look, I was lied to. I can't do much for myself. He was my servant. He betrayed me. I'm glad you're home safe. Give him everything. I don't care about that stuff, but I just ask for a little bit of mercy." So he's not interested in wealth. I tend to believe his story for that reason. He doesn't want the spoils of this. He just wants to know that David, who I think in modern day we might refer to David almost as his godfather, as a man who promised to kind of care for him in the absence of his own father, who blessed him and kind of took him under his wing. He's just glad that he's home, glad that he's safe. So he says, "You know what, give him everything." Now, Barzillai, the Gileadite, had come down from Roglim, and he went to the Jordan with the king to escort him over the Jordan. Now, Barzillai was very old, being 80 years old, and he had sustained the king while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very great man. The king said to Barzillai, "You cross over with me, and I will sustain you in Jerusalem with me." But Barzillai said to the king, "How long have I yet to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I'm 80 years old. Can I distinguish between good or bad? Or can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Or can I hear any more the voice of singing men and women? Why then should your servant be an added burden to my lord the king? Your servant would merely cross over the Jordan with the king. Why should the king compensate me with this reward? Please let your servant return that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and mother. However, here is your servant, Kimham. Let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what is good in your sight." The king answered, "Kimham shall cross over with me, and I will do good for him what is good in your sight. And whatever you require of me, I will do for you." All the people crossed over the Jordan, and the king crossed too. Then the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own place. So he's too old to go. But he's got this code of honor about him that says, someone's got to go. It's not David's fault. It's not the king's fault that I can't fulfill my obligation. So here is my servant. It's actually his son. And my son's going to go in my stead. That was a normal thing to happen. In fact, that was a very normal thing to happen, even up to, I believe, about the Civil War, where if a father couldn't go and fight, that the son of the household would go in his stead. It wasn't uncommon. It wasn't considered weird or anything like that. It just is something that happened. But here's the thing, and here's what I love about that part. There's never nothing that we can do. There's a lot of people who think, well, you know what? There's not much that I can do to help. I don't have the ability. I don't have the resources. I don't have the time. I don't understand it. Maybe they think that they're too old, or for whatever reason it is they have. People will sometimes come to this conclusion that there's nothing they have to offer. And I would say that's always wrong. As long as a person is breathing, they have something they can offer. As long as they're conscious, as long as they're aware, as long as they have a mind that they can control, there's something they can offer. Can you pray for someone? Can you serve? Can you support someone in the field? Can you help get the word out? Can you do something that frees up someone else so that they can go and do the thing that's needed? There's always something we can do. And when we start thinking there's nothing we can do, well, there's only one thing left to do after that, and that's just to die. And I hate to be graphic about it or crude about it, but the minute we resign ourselves to the idea that we're all used up and there's nothing left, well, the question is, okay, what is then left? What are we waiting for? What are we looking forward to? And I've met so many people, they're just going through life. They're just getting through the day and getting through the day. And you ask them, what is it you're working towards? What is it that you're passionate about? How are you helping? What are you doing? And so many times the answers are just going day by day. Just waiting for the weekend, just waiting for Monday, just waiting for Friday, just waiting for payday, just waiting to get through this week and this month and this year, and just waiting for this and just waiting for that. Their whole life is nothing but waiting. And ultimately, you realize they're just waiting for it to be over. I think it's a sad, very sad place to be. There's always something we can do. There's prayer we can offer. There's encouragement we can offer. There's things that we can do to serve someone. Barzillai is too old to go with David, but he says, you know what? There's something I can do. I can help. I can financially support your expedition. I can give you what you need. I can send my son. I can't do much, but I'll tell you what, I can make sure that something happens. And so the king blesses him, and he returns to his place. Verse 40 is a very interesting one. I'm just looking at our time. We have a little bit of time left. I don't think we have enough time to get all the way through the next chapter, but I really wish chapter 20 started now, because from here on out, things are going to be very, very different in Israel. David is coming home as king. Things look like they're well and good, but he's going from one storm into another. And in fact, this will be the one that ultimately leads to the breakup of Israel as a nation. They will divide and fight an actual civil war, not just rebellion, not just arguing over who's in charge, but the nation will divide. There will be a north and a south. The armies will fight. There'll be two kings. They're going to live that way for a while. There's going to be a lot of problems, and all of it is going to come out of David's line. So David will come home as king, and you know, after David, the next king is what? King Solomon, right? And Solomon is a wise man. He prays for wisdom. God makes him wise. He writes the Proverbs. He's a good king in a lot of ways. But like his father, he's got a girl problem. And Solomon has a lot of wives, a lot of concubines, 1,000 of them to add them all up, multiple sons. They're going to split the kingdom. As Solomon dies at the end of his life, Rehoboam will lead the faction of Judah, which is in the south. It's two tribes that'll split off from the rest of Israel. It's Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. And then in the north, Jeroboam will lead Israel, which is the remaining 10 tribes. They're going to fight and they're going to argue. And we read about it in 1 Kings chapter 12, where this whole thing starts to kind of unravel. And it's in that chapter, you don't have to go there, but it happens when it says that Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king, and Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard about it, and he was living in Egypt. It says that he comes home, and the assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, "Your father made our yoke hard. Now therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke, which he's put on us, and we'll serve you." So here's the deal. Solomon taxed the people very heavily. Saul taxed the people very heavily. David didn't really do that as much, but the people have been suffering for years and years and years under a very oppressive tax system. We think taxes are high here in America. You should have lived back then. 70-80% taxes. I mean, it was just astronomical what the people were paying to fund the government and all the wars and all the rebuilding and all the reconstruction. And so what happens is Rehoboam rises up and Solomon has died and he's about to become king. And just to kind of put it in a nutshell, the people come to Rehoboam and they say, "Hey, look, taxes have been really hard. It's hard to feed our families. Everybody here's on edge. If you just ease up just a little bit, we're going to pay taxes. You don't have to worry about that. But if you just reduce them just a little bit, then you know what? We're going to serve you. We're going to be happy." So Rehoboam goes to his advisors. Now, he's a young guy, but he's got a mix of advisors on his council, some older advisors, some younger ones. And the older guys say, "You know what? You should do this. It's a good thing. They're right. It's oppressive. They're having a hard time. It's a great time to win some hearts and minds. Listen to what they're telling you." Well, the younger guys say, "You know, I don't think you should do it that way. In fact, I think what you ought to do is you ought to go back there and you can tell them where they can stick it." Well, that's exactly what Rehoboam does. He goes back to the people and he says this, not the wisest thing to respond, but he says this: "My father made your yoke heavy. I will add to it. My father disciplined you with whips. I'll use scorpions." So the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn of events from the Lord that he might establish his word, which the Lord spoke through Ahijah, the Shilonite, to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. So you have this whole issue where the king comes in very heavy-handed, oppresses the people. That is where the nation breaks. Israel will break into two factions, and they'll fight this civil war, and eventually they'll come back together again. They're going to be invaded and conquered. But all of that starts here in verse 40. This is where those events kind of start moving. We start to see the division of the nation. We start to see the tribes kind of developing their own cultural identity, their own political identity, the upper class, the lower class. You've got the North and the South, the Union and the Confederacy. You've got, you know, the one side versus the other. You've got those loyal to the crown. You've got the rebels. You've got two very different ideologies and very different political philosophies. And what they're going to do is it's going to snap this nation in two. But it starts here as David's coming back in. All of that happens through the hands of his grandchildren who come from his son Solomon, who was born after his affair with Bathsheba. He was the second son. Now the king went on to Gilgal, and Kimham went on with him, and all the people of Judah and also half the people of Israel accompanied the king. So we're already seeing some division. There's half of Israel, there's Judah. There's some people going one way, some people going another. The 10 and the 2 are starting to divide. And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, "Why had our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household and all David's men with him over the Jordan?" Then all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, "Because the king is a close relative to us." And they're right. David comes from the tribe of Judah. And so it's a family affair. You know, we're welcoming him back. And Judah remained, you know, fairly loyal to David. It was the first place he was king. And so they kind of think, you know, this is our privilege to do this. And so we're going to bring him back. "Why then are you angry about this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense? Or has anything been taken for us?" But the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, "We have 10 parts in the king." So there's 10 tribes of us. Remember, there's that division. Israel is naturally divided geographically, topographically, geologically, you name it. There's this natural break between the 10 tribes in the north, the 2 tribes in the south. And so the 2 tribes are thinking, you know what? We don't really get treated very fair. There's 10 up there, and they're saying, yeah, there are 10 of us. There's 10 parts in the king. Therefore, we also have more claim on David than you. "Why then did you treat us with contempt? Was it not our advice first to bring back our king?" Which it was. Remember, why is it that Judah isn't bringing him back? "Yet the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel." So David is escorted back into Israel by Judah. But Israel thought, you know, the greater Israel thought, you know, there's 10 of us, there's more of us, we're way more of the population than you are. You know, the laws that they pass in Jerusalem affect us a lot more than you. We pay way more taxes than you. More of our men fight in the wars than you. And so when it comes to welcoming home the king, this is our privilege, our honor. And so there's this argument, there's this division, and they start dividing. And it's this family feud. It's within Israel. The civil war is brewing. And it's interesting how it kind of starts with a little bit of a grief. You know, it's not answered very well, at least not the way they were hoping to be answered, which leads to more scorn, more resentment, which leads to more bitter words. And again, Jesus warning that a house divided can't stand. You know, division in ministry can't stand either. And I've had the privilege of speaking with a number of pastors over the years who have been, in many cases, very good pastors. A lot of them, you know, much better than me in almost every regard, but I've learned from a lot of them. But I've also been able to witness some other ministries where things didn't go very well. There was division in the ministry. The pastor was at odds with the board, or maybe there was a division among the elders, or maybe different groups in the church weren't getting along, and there wasn't a clear understanding of how things were going to be done. Sometimes division comes in a ministry because of people who think that God has given them some kind of a call to take a faction of that church or of that group and go do something completely different without the blessing of the existing leadership. I'll say, I don't believe God ever condones that kind of thing. I was actually speaking with a person not too long ago who was telling me that years ago they were involved with the youth group here at the church, and they just felt the Lord called them to take the youth group and go plant another church. And I said, oh, well, did the church like plant that? Like, how did that go? And they said, oh, no, they were mad. They didn't want us to leave, but we felt God calling us. And I stopped them and I said, to split the church? To destroy the ministry? I said, I've heard this story. I didn't know it was you. Now, they were visiting. I haven't seen them since. I'd never seen them before. But I'll tell you, I have heard that story. And it is never shared in a very positive way. Division doesn't lead to harmony. It doesn't lead to blessing. It doesn't lead to prosperity. Again, it's when we're working together. Paul said it to the Philippian church, be united in one mind, one heart, You're working together for the sake of the gospel. He said, I implore Euodia and Syntyche to agree together. Many times in his writings, Paul implored believers, work together, agree together, one heart, one mind, one work, one church, one Bible, one God, one faith. You know, the outside world looks on the church, and when they see factions and they see infighting, it's not a very powerful witness that we have a God that unites people. And so it's vital that you have unity in leadership, unity in ministry. Our elders here, we meet as a board every month, and I'll tell you, we don't do anything that isn't unanimous. And it's not like we have a bylaw that says we've got to do that. It's because every one of our elders believes in the power of unity in leadership, because if you've got leaders that aren't agreeing, what's that going to do to the rest of the church? As you see here, what happens when David and his son are fighting? What happens when the two sides of the nation don't get along? What happens when different tribes aren't speaking to one another? And so here we have this division happening again. It's not going to lead to anything positive, and in fact, this division is going to divide the whole nation. And so, the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel. Judah is much smaller. The only other tribe Judah will have in all of this is going to be the tribe of Benjamin, and later Benjamin's going to say, you know, we have no portion in all this either. We're kind of isolated. We're alienated. So you've got 10 verses 2, and the two are like, no one's speaking for us. We're the little guy. We're the household of this king, and yet nobody seems to care about all that. And so all of that is going to come to a head. And so it begins in chapter 20, and just for a minute here, we'll look at a couple verses. Now, a worthless fellow. I just stop right there. If the Bible calls you worthless, probably not a good thing. But it says it, a worthless fellow. In Hebrew, it literally means a scoundrel, a wicked person, a person of destruction, a worthless person. He has no worth. He happened to be there, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. Remember the other half of, you know, Judah and Benjamin, verse the other 10. And he blew the trumpet and said, we have no portion in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his own tent, O Israel. So he's a worthless man. His name is Sheba. Now, names in the Bible can be very telling. When Adam and Eve had their first son, his name was Cain. And the Hebrew for Cain translates to has attained. Because you remember the promise that God made that the seed of the woman would rise up and crush the head of the serpent. So they have a firstborn. It's a boy. And they go, hey, look, we've attained the promises of God. Here's the seed of the woman. His name is Cain. Well, Cain turns out to be a pretty rotten seed. And so he rises up and he kills his brother Abel, as you know. Well, Abel's name also has a meaning, to ascend. And so you can start to see the thinking of Adam and Eve as parents. Oh, we've attained the promises of God through Cain, has attained. And because of that, Abel will ascend in those promises. So they're starting to put it all together. Here's the promise. We're going to go back to the Lord through this promise. So has ascend or will ascend. That's the promise that God makes, that Abel will rise up because of the promise that Cain fulfills. Well, as you know, both of those two boys are lost. Cain kills Abel, so Abel dies. God banishes Cain forever, puts a mark on his head, so he wanders forever. And so they've lost Cain. They have another son named Seth, which essentially means to start over. Names have a meaning is my point. Moses means to be drawn out of the water. There's just so many names like that in Scripture. Well, this is one of them too. His name is Sheba, and his name implies he will be worthless because it translates literally to two Israel's. That's what his name means, to Israel's. And it's a fitting name because he will be the one that sparks the division of this one nation into two. He says, we have no portion in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tent, O Israel. They're not going to help you. You're cut off. Forget about them. You're going to have to fend for yourself. So all of the men of Israel withdrew from following David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah remained steadfast to their king from the Jordan even to Jerusalem. Then David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, the concubines whom he'd left to keep the house, and placed them under guard and provided them with sustenance, but did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living as widows. Then the king said to Amasa, you remember him, he's the new general. Joab's out, Amasa's in, he served Saul. He served Absalom. And so Amasa's there, David's brought him back. He says, call out the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself. So Amasa went to call out the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the time which he had appointed him. So here we are, we're in civil war again. David has a lot of issues in life. He's got one civil war with his son, but this one's going to be real. This is the real deal. This is tribes are allying with tribes. They're dividing among themselves. And so here is this guy, Sheba. And I think he's a great example of the people who are just waiting to seize the opportunity for division. They sense there's blood in the water. They're like sharks. And the minute they can tell that someone is a little bit disenfranchised or maybe there's a little bit of dissension with some kind of thing that's gone on, in come the Shebas of the world. Oh, well, you know, right? You're right. This is terrible and you shouldn't do that. And oh, this shouldn't be that way. And I'll tell you what, why don't we go and make a difference? Why don't we go fix this thing? And oh, you know what? You're upset too. Well, join with us because we're going to really fix this stuff together. And what is a micro crack becomes a fissure, which becomes separation completely. I don't know if you recognize the strategy here, but it's very similar to what the serpent did to Eve in the garden. Did God really say that you will die or that you shouldn't eat this fruit or that you would die? And what did Eve say? Oh, yeah, he said that if we eat it or touch it, that we're dead meat. Well, the serpent recognized that there was a crack in the armor. Because while God did say, do not eat, he never said, do not touch. And so the serpent knew that there was a misunderstanding. There was a crack there that Eve didn't really understand the command. And he used that as a way to weasel his way in. And he separated people from God. Well, Sheba's doing the same thing. Finding this crack, this chink in the armor, so that he can weasel his way in, exploit it, and blow up the whole thing. So that's exactly what he does. David recognizes what's going on, and he realizes, look, this is way bigger than anything Absalom did. This is bigger than when Saul died and I fought his son. This is bigger than what we did with Absalom. This really has the potential to become a big problem. From here, Israel will enter this continuous spiral downward. And it's almost like every time they recover from something, it's always less than they had before. So Israel is freed and God is in charge and they have peace with their neighbors. They're here. You remember they fire God. They say, we need a king. We need someone that you know can fight our battles. And God's like, well, I've been fighting your battles. You don't need a king. He's going to tax you and take your men. He speaks to the prophets. The people say, no, we want a king. So God says, okay, gives them Saul. And there's all kinds of issues. Immediately they're at war again. And they're always fighting to get back to where they were. Only there's never quite peace again. Even when there is peace, it's you know kind of a weak peace. It's very fragile. And they're always facing threats on every border. Well, then what happens? Saul disobeys the Lord, and he offers that sacrifice instead of Samuel. And Samuel says, you know what, because of this, God's going to fire you, and brings David in. And then there's fighting, and even through David's life, it's trying to get back up to the blessing that they had before. Well, David's anointed by God, so the nation rises. And they're at their peak under David, but then he sins. He falls away from the Lord with Bathsheba, and Israel is in real trouble. Because of that, there's another rebellion with Absalom. They fight for a peace, but, you know, here they are again. They're just trying to get back to where they were, only it's very shaky. You still have some people that are loyal to Absalom here. You have Sheba who recognizes that. But then David wins the war. So, look, we're trying to get back to where we were before the whole mess started. And then Sheba comes in, and it's just this constant struggle to get back to where they were, and they'll never get there. The point in all of that is to say we will never do better on our own and with our own plans than we will with God's plan. I have a friend, a little guy. You know, people just don't keep their pets at home sometimes. But we'll never do better with our own ideas than we will with God's. It was God's plan to say, hey, I'm your king. You have peace. You have promised land. You the land of milk and honey. I'm winning your battles. You're at peace with the Philistines. Things are great. Well, they have their own ideas. And their own ideas lead to trouble, which leads to more trouble, which leads to more trouble. Always trying just to get back to that last level of goodness, knowing that they're never going to quite get there. Well, that's where they are here. They're dividing, and they're about to fight. You know, this is what people naturally do. I said at the very beginning, we like to divide. Our nation is a divided nation. There's no doubt about it. Some people say that we are more divided now than we ever have been. Some people don't think we are. They think it's just that we're more aware of it. I tend to think the division goes pretty deep, and whether it's worse than it's ever been, I don't know, but we're aware of how deep it goes. It's pretty bad. And you look at the fallout of all of that. You look at our place in the world stage. You look at the single parenthood rate of families in America. You look at the abortion rate of children in America. You look at the dropout rate from high school in America. STDs, you look at drug use, you look at all of these things that seem to be coming out of this whole idea that, you know, we're better off separate than we are united, and it doesn't seem to be working. And so I think as a very good kind of takeaway from all of this is just the importance of being united. Imagine if our community, just our local community, looked at our church. And they said, you know what? You've got different politics in there. You've got different economics in there, different levels of education, different jobs. You've got people rooting for different sports teams in there. You've got everybody involved in different stuff. They have different lives. But you know what? They are in lockstep with one another. That's a powerful thing. Imagine if the entire Christian community of our nation rose up with one solidary voice and said, you know what, we're going to follow God, and we're going to vote that way, and we're going to live that way, and we're going to spend that way, and we're going to support things that bring our nation back in line with God's scripture. And that's how 100 million of us are going to go. That's how 150 million of us are going to go. You know what? We're not going to tell you what to do. This is how all of us are going to do it. Our nation would turn around in a week. Unity is a powerful, powerful thing, which is why the enemy seeks to divide. You know, there's a saying, divide and conquer. It exists for a reason. The Bible tells us in the New Testament, in the book of Peter, to be watchful, to be on the lookout, that your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for those whom he may devour. Another way to look at that is to look for those who are isolated, who've been divided from the group, the ones who are going it alone, the ones who have decided, you know what, I'm better off by myself than with others. Looking for the easy targets, looking for the ones he may devour. If Israel had remained united, if Sheba had not gotten into power, the civil war that's about to come wouldn't come. But I think if we saw that kind of unity in our society today, it's amazing how much healing we would have. But they're about to go down this road. And so the king says to Amasa, get the army ready. Call the men of Judah for me. Do it in 3 days. This is going to be bad. We've got to get out ahead of this before it really takes root. And we're going to see that develop next week. Father, we thank you for tonight and for the time to dive into your word. Lord, I pray that as we have been reading and studying and seeing the value of just how powerful and how moving and changing it can be when believers, when your children, your people stand up united. Lord, I pray that the community here, our local town, would see us united, marching together, walking together, doing life together. Lord, with one voice, with one heart, for one cause, with one gospel. What a powerful message that would be of a God who has the power to heal and to bring together and restore relationships and mend hearts and mend homes. That people would see that on display here at our church. Lord, I pray that that would be true in each and every one of our lives. And that as we go from here, that we would reflect that out into the world around us. Lord, please keep us safe and bless us and guide us as we go forward united in Jesus' name. Amen. Have a great rest of your week. And remember, we have How to Read the Bible Book by Book. If you're interested in it tonight, it is available. Sunday it'll be available. It's a great tool. Highly recommend it. But God bless. We'll see you on Sunday.